What kind of law do you practice?
Law, captain.
Maritime law.
On what grounds could you possibly prevail?
Grounds? Who cares about grounds? Cases always come down to who the jury likes better.
Mr. Foley, I must warn you that if you attempt to belly rag or bulldoze this witness, I shall take very dim view of it.
Your lordship is most pretty.
Very well, then you may proceed.
Cash settlement. I could have figured that out, you button-down maggot!
You have any cream?
Oh, yes, of course. Where are my manners?
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 365. Wow, that means you can start episode one on January 1st of a year and get to now. I don't know why you'd want to do that, but you could, and it would be a full year. Anyway, how are you doing, Andrew?
I'm looking up after that now that you can get opening arguments every day for an entire year. That's I feel
we
good.
We can even do. Yeah. We can pause it like a quarter through this episode. It'd be 365 and a fourth. Perfect. Count for the leap year.
It's sidereal, right? Exactly. So,
yeah. We have even more fun stuff to talk about. I am so excited about this episode. It's music law. We're going to talk about the kind of viral story that some programmers wrote every possible melody and tried to, you know, copyright that. And as a reminder, go back and listen to our Led Zeppelin episode because that was so much fun. It was peanut butter and chocolate. It was a marriage made in heaven. It was music, which is kind of my passion, and law, of course, which Andrew knows something about. And it was a ton of fun. And we both unite, Andrew, on Led Zeppelin, right? Isn't that the place?
Oh yeah, where we absolutely. Okay, I mean, we were a two man Voltron on that episode. Absolutely,
so much fun. But we could do that, and then also we get
people Clarence get to hear Thomas. People get to hear you play guitar, which is super cool. Like you're super good at it. So yeah. I mean, they get to hear that.
I'm okay.
They get to hear that. Every episode in the opening and closing credits.
True. That's
but
true.
You covering some
fun.
Led
play Zepp. A little Stairway. Yeah. I got a chance. I'd never learned Stairway because it was always the
play Stairway.
We had Wonderwall. Does every generation have the song that you're the kind of the door? Like, so I don't know if you know this, Andrew, but in high school you got the guitar guys, and mm-hmm. I only was barely one because my parents didn't let me have anything, but eventually I was able to have a guitar for like a semester of high school. But there's the song that everybody learns because it's like the easy song to, you know, to be able to play and sound like you kind of play. And for us, that was Wonderwall. That was my era's song. I wonder what your, you know, like your era, high school era's song was that everybody would learn. And everyone's like, ah, you can only play Wonderwall kind of thing.
Huh.
Well, everyone, report in.
Yeah,
tell us what that was
please,
for you.
Please do. If you went to high school in the late 80s, early 90s.
Anytime that's not me, which because I know Wonderwall was ours. Other than that, I'm very curious to hear what anybody's was. Nowadays, it's just every song on the radio because they're all three chords and it's easy. Anyway, let's get to music.
Hey, we're already and there. Also,
yeah, and I just want to tease, you know, the Clarence Thomas stuff. That's going to be super fun to hear him argue with himself, I guess, in the main segment. And then we've got a wild card segment, listener question. Hopefully we'll get to. Depends on how music law goes and Clarence Thomas law. But that's our agenda. Now let's get to music law, Andrew.
Yeah, I can play the guitar. I can play your basic rhythm guitar like jug jugga jug jugga jug jugga jug jugga jug jugga jug jug jugga 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 jug something like that.
So, set us up. I mean, I already kind of did, but some programmers wrote every possible melody. Now there's going to have to be some constraints on that, right? Like, is it every four note melody? Is it every, what are the constraints on that?
Yeah. So this is a story from Vice that has come to our attention about two gentlemen, Damian Real and Noah Rubin, And I'm going to read to you two paragraphs from the article, because I'm skeptical about the first one, and then the second one is I don't understand it. So I'm going to ask for your expertise. All right. So, lead paragraph. Two programmer musicians wrote every possible MIDI melody, M-I-D-I, MIDI. Right? Melody in existence to a hard drive, copyrighted the whole thing, and then released it all to the public in an attempt to stop musicians from getting sued. Okay. I'm going to be able to explain all the law stuff around that. The music question is, every melody in existence? So here's the definition that they use. Okay.
Well, can I also point out that every MIDI melody is, that's redundant. So that doesn't, that they might have used MIDI. So MIDI stands for musical instrument digital interface. Mm-hmm. That's just like what, when you are using electronic music, you know, MIDI is like the
yeah, it's the internet, right? It's like the USB of, right?
Yeah, essentially. It's, you know, anything that I do, a lot of our OpenARG song, for example, is MIDI. You know, it's just that. So it's kind of redundant to say they wrote every MIDI melody. There's no difference between writing a, like, MIDI melody to copyright it versus I played these four notes on guitar and copyrighted. Like, they would be the same thing. It's just MIDI is like the format that it's in.
Okay. Kind of. Okay. So, and we're going to talk about that in a second in terms of how that interfaces with copyright law. But here, when we say,
and also this is just bad writing. I'm sorry. This is Vice, right? Two programming musicians wrote every possible MIDI melody in existence. What is that in existence? So they don't exist. So they wrote them. Do they exist or not?
So here's the methodology, and you tell me.
Sure.
Quote, to determine the finite nature of melodies, this writing is interesting. Reel and Rubin developed an algorithm that recorded every possible 8-note, 12-beat melody combo.
Right.
12. Now, beats. Eight okay. notes in an octave, right?
Sure.
What's the 12 beat thing?
Yeah, I mean, what I was saying to lead this off, and now I'm looking at the same article you are, so we can be on the same page. But I wanted to know what the constraints would be, because obviously you have to set constraints on it because there are limits to computers. I mean, if you, and it would go out of control very, very, very quickly. I mean, just think about how many different melodies you could do with one note. You know, in 12 beat, just the timing. So it could be like, duh, like you could just have a note for the entire 12 beats. Duh, two, three, four, one, two, three. Like that would be one. And then you could have that, duh, except, and it also would matter how fine grained they do. So how much they divide the beats in. Is it going to be a 16th note, a 32nd note, a 64th note, 128th note? Because think about that. So you do one note. So I'm just talking about the most basic. You do one note for the entire time, 12. And then once you get to 10, 11, 12, like on the very end, you would have silence on the last 128th beat. And that would be one melody. And then you would, you know, and this is what if they're brute forcing it, that may sound ridiculous, you know, what I'm describing, but if you're brute forcing it, that has to be part of it. So like every single weird, and just think about how many different combinations there are just with the most basic stuff. So they, you know, I don't know how fine grained they're going on the beats. By the way, if you are, and again, I agree with you that to determine the finite nature of melodies makes no sense. To determine the finite nature of melody. What do they mean? Like to constrain the melodies to a finite portion? Is that what they're trying to
say? Here's, you tell me from a musical perspective, because from a law perspective, here's what I think it might mean. And that is if we have eight notes in an octave, we know from the George Harrison, My Sweet Lord, the chiffons, He's So Fine, right? That is shifted an octave or maybe even a partial octave, right? Like, so in other words,
did we determine that? I can't remember.
I feel with a huge confidence interval that
so,
we did.
So here's what, okay, I'll let you finish.
So, no, sorry. So
Okay. So you think, is that in a different key? That's right. Not shifted in octave.
Okay, I'm sorry. I said, my musical stupidity is coming through loud.
Well,
and clear.
Here, I'll give you an example. So here's a melody. Now, is this going to, now that you let me know if we can't air, can we air me humming a few seconds of melodies?
Yes.
Does that work?
Yes.
Okay. Here's the melody. Da, 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 da. And I'm guessing what's also copyrighted is da, 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 and da, 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 you know, so just changing the key doesn't get you out of the fact that it's already Star Wars kind of thing.
Right, right. And so
that's the, he's so fine, may have been a different key.
Okay.
The part where it's 8 notes in an octave, I'll tell you where that comes into play. So that actually very much limits it. This is not at all, when they keep saying every possible melody, that's not correct. There's no possible way. I'll give you a melody that's 1 note, different octaves. Ready? Oh, I added. There's okay. It might be 2 notes, but for the most part, that's just an octave. Da 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 da. And so, if they're only doing 8 notes, they're not going to have anything where it goes out of the octave. Now, I don't know in music copyright law if I were to take a song that goes out, you know, it goes into multiple octaves, which it pretty much every song does. And if I were to crunch all that down into one octave, now that I think about it, yeah, maybe that would still be copyrighted. I don't know. So maybe, okay, I may be going back on myself here. I don't know how copyright law works with, you know, that's your field, but if they kept everything within one octave, does that still mean they've done melodies that go into multiple octaves, even though they're just crunching it down? I don't know.
So here's my thought process on that, right?
But hold on, and I apologize. One more thing. Imagine if you, so there's My Sharona, right? You've got the bass line that's da-da-da-da-da-da. Right. Imagine if I was like, oh, well, I already copyrighted that because here's my song. It's da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You're like, that's not the same. Well, it's crunched down to one octave.
Okay, that's interesting, and yeah. I don't know how to adjudicate that. I think the thought process is as follows, right? That if you have a limited universe of notes, right, then by definition, there are a finite amount of arrangements of those notes, right? And
we can have the mathematicians decide if you go to 1/32nd, 1/64th, 128th, 120th. There is a limit to that, but it gets darn near infinite when you divide up the beats to extreme degrees. But that aside.
Okay. And look, I suspect, right, like later in the same article, the programmers say that the algorithm works at the rate of 300,000 melodies per second. Right. So we are talking about crunching, an awful lot of melodies. Right. Like I don't think they were like, sure, oh, yeah. And by the way, we ran the program for 8 seconds. Right. Like, no, that, you know, they clearly there are millions, billions, trillions, quadrillions, whatever. Huge sums, huge numbers of these melodies. And I think the idea is that the previous cases, right, like the George Harrison case, the pending Led Zeppelin case, which, again, we talk about episodes 236 and 288. They're really, really a lot of fun. That because small transformations have been held to be copyright violations, I think the idea is we get out sort of all the, quote, basic melodies. And once we do that, then everything is a small transformation on that basic melody. We've copyrighted all of the basic melodies, and then we've released them into the public domain, so therefore, no copyright. I'm going to explain all of the legal problems with that chain of inferences in a moment, but I understand what you're saying to be, oh, and by the way, like the factual predicate for that is just wrong, right?
I think there are problems with it. Now that I'm rereading this, I think I would have to interpret this, and this may be me overthinking things, by the way. There are probably people saying like, oh, Thomas, what are you talking about? I think I would interpret this now that I'm rereading it to be that they just did 12 notes, as in 12 whole notes. So like, there, which is not going to give you most melodies. Most melodies aren't just on the note. So if I'm going 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, et cetera, counting to 12, most melodies aren't da, da 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 da. Yeah, like there's more variation in the timing, in the rhythm. But I think if I'm interpreting this right, and it's just based on this article, which is not written that well, in my opinion, they're saying 8-note, 12-beat melodies. Because if you went with what I was saying, where you know, you can subdivide a beat into any number, you know, songs will commonly have 16th notes at the very least. So each beat would have potentially 16 more sub beats, sort of, you know, so to speak, as another places where you could either put notes or silence or whatever. But I think the only way this makes sense is if it's just one note per beat that they're doing. But I really don't know. It seems unclear to me.
Okay. And it was, I wish it were for show purposes. I wish it were more clear to you. For my awe of your musical knowledge, I'm glad that it was as impenetrable to you as it was to me, because I was worried that I was just an idiot.
Well, so. I want to add something else
here. And look, I am still an idiot, so please do.
No. I want to add something else in here, which is just melody. And this is going to be where there's my platonic ideal of how this law should work. And then there's what you and I have discussed in the past, which is the law is just honestly, it's kind of a conglomeration of case law where it seems to not make sense places. And it's not very consistent from my understanding of it. You can correct me if I'm wrong. But when you talk about any great song, any great hit. Now, nowadays it's getting simpler and simpler, and that's mathematically demonstrated. That's not just me telling young people to get off my lawn.
Oh, but I am behind you on crankiness. Anyway, keep going.
Yeah. But great music, it's not just about the melody. Like da da da, like it's not just about the main, it's about the chords underneath.
Mine goes ding 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 ding.
Yeah. Yeah. Dum 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 dum. It's about the chords underneath it as well, and the variations that you play under. You know, you can have a 4-note sequence and have near infinite chord progressions underneath it. Or, you know, I guess it's technically finite, but once you, you know, talk about timing, orchestration, any number of other variables, you get into near infinite possibilities just on one melody. And it depends. Now, since we're dealing with 8 notes, I don't know if they picked that because they thought that would be like the minimum copyrightable amount. But I think we discussed in the last music show we did, it seemed like the last case to go the way we didn't think it should go dealt with a very finite, what, 3 chords was it? Or
yeah,
it was. Yeah. So anyway, sorry to.
No. That is, look, when this article came to my attention, if you follow us at OpenArgs on Twitter, right, before looking into the law, before looking into just reading the headline, my response was, well, you know, let's see about that, you know, feasibility of we've generated every single melody in existence. And I strongly suspected, no, you didn't. And seems to be what you're,
but you know, maybe the argument they're making that you mentioned is if it's in broad strokes every possible 8-note, 12 beat, I'm not sure what they mean, but we'll say eight possible notes. And by the way, I would add also being resting, so it should be silence should be a variable in there as well, because like it's not like every melody is da da da, like, you know, be a pause sometimes. But anyway, they may be making the argument that it'll be close enough to something. Like you may have an example that has more fine tuning, that has like little timing issues, but like it's close enough to where everything could be looked at as a derivative melody. And I mean, that's up to, I guess, you to tell me if that'll make sense. Musically, that kind of makes sense.
Okay, so let's assume that musically it makes sense, right? Let's, and I don't want to discard what we've just done, because I learned a lot from that, and I suspect that it is more complicated than that. Let's talk about the concept, right? I generate the minimum protectable, copyrightable elements of every melody in existence. I then fix that to a medium, and here what they've done is they've put it on a hard drive in digital format, which is a totally valid way to register a copyright, by the way. And in fact, one of the requirements of copyright, we talked about this in the Led Zeppelin case, is that an original work must be fixed in a permanent medium, right? That made more sense back at, you know, the dawn of recorded time than, you know, sort of it does now. But for example, we have case law that basically says a live performance of a song, right? This came into play in the Led Zeppelin case, because what was copyrighted of the it's either the Spirit Song Taurus or the Taurus Song Spirit. It's the Taurus Song Spirit. Sorry. Took me a second,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I can never remember either way.
So, yeah, well, I should repeat Andrew Taurus.
It's Taurus by Spirit, right?
Yes, it is. It's no, the Spirit.
Oh, wait.
Yes, it's the Spirit. We're never going to get it right.
I can't remember.
Anyway.
Though. Either way.
Yes. So the argument was they wanted to play for the jury the live performance, mm-hmm. which is what the members of Led Zeppelin had access to because they opened for Spirit, right? But what was copyrighted was the deposit version, right? So which you played, right? The actual physical written down transcribed notes of the song. And part of the argument that was being made on appeal was, well, yeah, but like what they heard when Spirit played it live was very right. different from the sort of dry version that's in the mm-hmm. deposit, right? And so in terms of the copying that took place, that was an evidentiary question. So we're not going to revisit it for Led Zeppelin. Go back, listen to episodes 288, 236. We go through all of this. But in terms of the question of, can you get a computer to spit out every possible melody subject to the discussion that we just had, and then save it in a digital format and copyright that digital sequence? Yes, you can. That is considered fixation in a tangible medium, which is one of the requirements for copyright. Then the issue is, think about what they're trying to do. What they're trying to do is to say, look, now we've copyrighted all the other possible melodies. And so that means that the next time somebody comes along and writes a song, and then somebody comes along after that and writes a song which artist A says infringes his earlier work, then artist B, who's written the allegedly infringing song, will be able to go back and be like, no. Artist A, you just stole one of the melodies from Reel and Reuben. How do we know you stole one of the melodies from Reel and Reuben? Because all melodies
pulled up in our database.
Yeah, all melodies are Reel and Reuben databases. And I want to tell you, this logic is not correct in copyright law. Okay,
nice.
The concept is a concept called prior art, and that is correct when it comes to trademark law, for example. It's okay. It is correct when it comes to trademark law, right? So in other words, I can't trademark an arrangement that is a previous arrangement that has been trademarked, right? Super obvious examples. I decide that, you know, what really the law is about is getting more from your lawyer. And so I want the symbol for the law offices of P. Andrew Torres to be a giant M, right? A giant yellow M with kind of curved peaks on a red background, because you get more from your lawyer. And, you know, and everybody would be like, well, that looks an awful lot like the golden arches of McDonald's. And I'll be like, well, you know, it's meant to be a big M. I'm sorry.
For some reason, I'm even hungrier to be your client.
More for your money. Right. I can't register that as my trademark because of the prior art that is the McDonald's trademark that is already registered. In copyright, it doesn't quite work that way, right? It finding a previous version, even if it's identical, does not automatically invalidate a copyright. because here's what has to go on, right? In addition to fixing it in a tangible medium, to copyright an original expression, you have to have those two elements, right? Number one, it must be an expression, right? We've talked about this before. You can't copyright an idea. You can't say, I want to have a TV show where, you know, a shouty chef goes around to restaurants and like brings in cameras and tells them that their food is terrible and right? Like you can't do that. That's why there are multiple different, which I love dearly, shouty chef reality shows on TV. You can, however, copyright the actual expression, right? You can say we are copywriting, Gordon Ramsay's, restaurant makeover, right? And if somebody else wants to do a show, like they've got to do it differently, right? They can use the same basic idea, but they can't use the underlying copyrightable elements. How do you know what those underlying elements are? That's the other word, right? So in addition to expression, it must have originality. And then the question is, how original is original? And the answer to that threshold is pretty low, right? So we've talked about what is the minimum protectable? There's no bright line. But obviously like playing an A flat, right? You can't protect A flat, right? But can you protect a four note sequence, right? Can you, and the law is sort of in flux as to what constitutes sort of the minimum protectable elements from a song. Okay. And now if you put that together, right, the way in which prior art works in copyright is when you prove that somebody has not engaged in any originality in their work, but they are merely copying the work of someone else, right? Mm. So, right, I produce a novel and, you know, and it begins, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And you're like, okay, we're super certain that you didn't write that, right? Yeah. Like, it's not hard to go out and find the original. And so the fact that there is widely available prior art gives rise, and then the fact that, you know, I am word for word identical to Tale of Two Cities, right? Like it you would look at that and go, okay, I can't prove that Andrew copied Tale of Two Cities, but we can draw a very, very strong inference, which in civil law is sufficient to say, yeah, Tale of Two Cities is publicly available.
Yeah, every time if this came up, it would be, well, obviously I haven't heard your hard drive.
Yeah.
Right? Isn't that part
of
it?
That's exactly right. And so in the music industry, right, we have, and in fact, again, this goes back to the George Harrison, right? The argument was that in writing My Sweet Lord, he unintentionally copied He's So Fine. Right. He didn't intentionally. And George Harrison produced all sorts of documentation as to the work that went into it. And the argument was, it's still not original if you accidentally copy someone else. Right. So that's the way in which prior art is relevant is it can prove that you've intentionally, you know, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, or that it's something that's out there in the public consciousness. You've heard it, you subconsciously relied upon it. And so, again, all of it goes into the question of, did you make an original creation? And that gets to, it's why I love doing this, the underlying question, which is, could you have simultaneous or even asynchronous original creations that are nevertheless substantially similar, right? Could you on your own produce a melody that these guys have already previously produced without copying it? And I think the answer really clearly is yes.
Obviously, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so think of some clear examples of this. Now, look, titles to songs, there's clear case law. The title to a song itself is not independently copyrightable. Okay.
Yeah.
And so I remember, because it was early in my childhood, when at the same time there were two separate songs, both called Learning to Fly, that were both in the top 10 at the same time, right? The Roger Waters less David Gilmour led Pink Floyd had a song called Learning to Fly, and Tom Petty had a song called Learning to Fly, and there have been subsequent songs called Learning to Fly, right? And it's not easy, it's not hard to figure out what happened there, right? Which was both artists sat down and started writing, and they both came up with Learning to Fly separately, right? There was no copying that went back and forth, so both songs were copyrightable. And ultimately, at the end of the day, there has never been a case of a copyright being granted where there is a word for word identical or unit for unit identical prior representation. But there's nothing in the law that prohibits it. Right. It's just the problem is that the more you have in common, the stronger it gives rise to the inference that it was copying, right? Either deliberate or accidental. But in this case, given how artificial it is, right? Like they just ripped all of these to a hard drive and then sent the hard drive to the copyright office. And by the way, put a pin in that. I want to talk about that in a second.
Oh, I have a pin I've been sitting nice. On waiting to touch.
Beautiful.
We're already at a half hour.
So there are zero cases in copyright where a copyright has been extended to something that is unit for unit identical to a previously published work. But there's nothing in the copyright law that I can find that would prohibit recognition of such a copyright so long as it meets the originality requirement, right? And usually, you know, it is, again, right. The more you go on, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, the more a jury is going to be like, well, come on, you ripped that off. But here you'd have really, if you were the plaintiff, you would have really, really strong evidence that you never ripped it off. Right. Like this was published in a digital format that, you know, I never accessed and was sent to the, you know, was filed with the copyright office. And so I think it's entirely possible that even if all of the factual predicates were correct, that you would have this super unique situation of a subsequent artist independently creating something and being able to get a copyright, even though there was a prior copyright that contained the exact same elements. It would be super fascinating. It's not going to happen because also, by the way, I think it's unlikely that the copyright office is going to recognize this copyright.
Well, would they? Yeah, wouldn't they have to like file each and every one of the 10 billion?
No, what they're melodies? Here's what they're going to say is they're going to say that the entire work is one copyright containing 10 to the 38th power independent separate copyrightable elements, right? Like you don't have to separately copyright, you know, all of the catchphrases on your TV show and all of the, right?
Gotcha.
Like the copyright includes the independently copyrightable material within it. That's why I can't have like a wizard named Dumbledore in my, you know, special new novel that I'm writing called Definitely Not Harry Potter, right? So that's what they're going to claim, but I don't know that they will get a copyright on the computer generation of all of the melodies, because I don't know that that is going to meet the originality requirement.
Interesting.
And the reason for that goes back to the fundamental case that underlies really all of copyright. Like it's the place you start when you analyze a copyright question. We've talked about it on the air before. It's a case called Feist Publications Incorporated versus Rural Telephone Services Company, $4.99 US 340 from 1991, which says that the telephone numbers, right, are not copyrightable within a telephone directory, right? Those are just facts. And even when you say, like, sure, oh, well, no, I had some minimum creativity because I organized them alphabetically, the Supreme Court was like, no, 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 no. Like, just taking...
Oh, that's a lot more like that.
Yeah.
This sounds like that.
It sounds exactly like that to me, right? If a telephone, if an old
phone
book... But
if you make a song called 8675309...
Yeah, well, one of the greatest songs of all time.
Exactly. Obviously. Then you've just copyrighted yourself a telephone number, bring it all together.
There you go. So so here's the summary. Number one, from you, it's definitely not every melody ever.
Well, let me I've been sitting on this for this entire time. Cause okay, I'm now trying, I've put this article through the somebody who's not a musician wrote this filter. And now what I'm seeing is they should not have said 12 beat. They should have just said they're doing every 12 note sequence for 8 notes. That's what they're doing. So that would ignore, you know, again, that would ignore my Mai Sharona example. So instead of da 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 da, that would just be da 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 da, which I would be interested. I would doubt a court would say that's a ripoff. Like, if, you know, because it's kind of critical that you jump octaves there. But also, I was looking at, I don't know if they include a silent beat, but if they don't, I guess you could, you wouldn't necessarily have to, because, like, say your melody is like, hey, Jude, you know, and then they're like, well, we had this one in our database. It goes, dun, dun, you know, and like holds it forever. I guess that would be close enough, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't know. But anyway, let's assume if they do have a silent note, that gives us 2.82 to the 11th power. And that would take 10.89 days at their rate. So that's still very achievable. If they only use the 8 notes and not a silent, like a rest, then it would only take them 2.65 days to do this. But that's, again, I want to emphasize, that's only 8 notes, 12 sequences. So that's just, unless I'm failing at my basic math, that's just 8 to the 12th power or whatever. Or sorry, is it 12 to the 8th? I already forget which I did. So
either
that,
way,
that's
not
more
a lot.
Simple.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's far more simple than, like, if you have an eighth note or 16th note or even a half note or whatever. So it's greatly, greatly simplifying what music is. And that's just a side note. So, yeah, I'm really glad to hear that in addition to those constraints, the law might actually, you know, be smart for once and be like, okay, well, this is stupid. Clearly, you didn't write every song. I also want to say, and this is, you know, I don't have my guitar on me or whatever, but when we talk about He's So Fine versus My Sweet Lord, yes, on paper, the melody that he is singing or the chiffons are singing is da da da, like that's it. You know, that's da na na, like there's, you know, handful of notes. Mm-hmm. It's almost nothing. And that's what would be in the computer program. But what makes those songs so clearly, or rather what makes George Harrison's song, in my opinion, so clearly a ripoff that he accidentally did. I don't think he did it intentionally, but just one of those things where he probably had it in his head somewhere because he, you know, he was touring for years and hearing music and all that, is that, like, it's the same chords too. Like, it's a A minor and a D, you know, and it's the timing of how it's sung. It's the phrasing of it that really give you those indications that, like, okay, this, in the, I don't know, I guess the jury's opinion, and in my opinion too, this does sound like he accidentally ripped this off, versus if you just plug this into the computer that there's a hard drive that they're saving all these on, it would just be dum, dum, dum. You know, it's like, well, that's not really the same. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There's more going on than that. You could have any number of chords underneath that melody, and it would sound to you and to anyone like a completely different song. It's not just the simple melody that makes songs. It's also the chords, the expression, the instrument, the everything.
I agree with all of that. And I think that provides even better levels, layers of details on the, this doesn't cover the universe of protectable stuff. But even if it did, and even if it were copyrightable in that format, which I'm not sure that it is, it would not accomplish the things that they're trying to accomplish. Look, I'm very happy that the story is out there and that we're able to cover it, because,
well, it sounds like they were just kind of messing around and doing an interesting thing. Yeah. I don't have any problem with that.
Yeah. And look, again, these folks are programmer musicians, so, you know, don't take legal advice from them. There's a little bit in the article I want to read from Real where he says, Under copyright law, numbers are facts. Again, 867-5309, right? And under copyright law, facts either have thin copyright, almost no copyright, or no copyright at all. So maybe if these numbers have existed since the beginning of time and we're just plucking them out, maybe melodies are just math, which is just facts, which is not copyrightable, which is insane. That is no. Don't take legal advice.
Well, I'm trying to interpret that a little more charitably, and that sounds like the telephone book example to me. Like, oh, if this is just, you know, if this is just combinations of numbers essentially that are out there, us, you know, rearranging the telephone book isn't really copyrightable. But maybe I'm being too charitable to what he said.
Well, but replace numbers with letters, and now no books are copyrighted, because what are words? Words are just a rearrangement of pre-existing letters that
and letters are numbers,
right? And you can put letters as
everything's
numbers.
Ones and zeros, yeah, really, right.
It's the reason in Feist publications that the phone book wasn't protectable in and of itself is because the arrangement of the core facts was not sufficiently creative, right? It was just, we did this alphabetically, right? Well, and I'm sorry, arranging facts alphabetically is not sufficient, right? But but look, here's a real world example, right? Almanacs absolutely 100% are copyrightable. I don't know that anybody uses almanacs anymore, but if you went out and took an almanac and just like ripped off the cover and put a brand new cover on it and tried to resell it, then the almanac company would absolutely 100% sue you, because it just contains facts, but it's the arrangement of those facts in a creative way that makes the almanac the almanac.
Okay.
So that's the fundamental mistake with the idea that facts have very little copyright protection in and of themselves. That's true, okay? But it's the arrangement of facts that then gains protection. And the fact that we can all recognize that music, even if the underlying notes are not individually protectable, it's the creativity is in the arrangement. And that's not going away. So
I like that there needs to be a creative element. So if, you know, if they just plucked at random and took 10 of these melodies and then, you know, did something with them and made an album out of it, then all of a sudden, there you go.
Agreed. So to summarize, number one, this isn't all of the protectable elements. Number two, it's probably not copyrightable. Number three, even if it was, this isn't going to do what they think it does. But number four, like, we want to have a debate about what 21st century copyright protection looks like, because there is no doubt that we are trying to shoehorn modern concepts into a very, very old law, right? And even the joke that I just made, right? The letters are really just numbers, right? Are ASCII numbers, which in turns are just ones and zeros. That joke would have made no sense at the time the copyright law was drafted, right? Because there wasn't digital, right? Like, so there is no doubt in my mind that copyright law is a robust area that needs revisiting. But this, while sparking the discussion, isn't going to do that.
Yeah. Fun conversation starter. All right. Well, it led us to use up most of our episode on this, but sorry. It's just, if we're talking music law, it's so fun.
I love it.
I'm really interested in it. But we've got to talk about what I guess is our quote-unquote main segment.
We'll go quickly.
Which is Clarence Thomas. Yep. Opening Arguments is brought to you by Echelon. Folks, to get fit in 2020, you don't have to join a gym or pay a ton for overpriced fitness equipment. The best way to get in the best shape of your life is with Echelon. Go to echelonfit.com right now to discover their EX1 connected fitness bikes that offer a high-quality at-home cycling experience at less than half the price of a Peloton. Echelon makes beautifully engineered products for everyone, and with daily live and on-demand studio classes right in your home, you'll never have to step foot in a gym. You'll love Echelon, but if you aren't 100% satisfied, they'll give you your money back. So don't pay a ton for Peloton. Buy an Echelon bike today for under $1,000. Go to echelonfit.com/opening to learn more about their limited time free Apple iPad and complete details of this exclusive offer. Echelon, it's your time. That's echelonfit.com/opening. echelonfit.com/opening.
Have you ever tried a jury trial?
I have not.
Civil?
No.
Every lawyer is tempted.
Criminal?
No.
Bench?
No.
Not only to eat forbidden fruit, but to become the snake.
State or federal court?
I have not.
Why am I persecuted?
So I saw, you know, I actually saw this in an email that said, was titled to us, by the way. It's titled Thomas Weirdness. And I was like, oh, great. Another comment on my appearance about our YouTube videos. And I was pleased to discover actually wasn't
different
me.
Thomas was weird.
I'm so vain that I thought this email was about me. Nice. It's about Clarence Thomas. So what happened?
Yeah. And the headline I saw, this is actually a Fox News headline. And I'd give them credit because this was funny.
Wow. Yeah.
It was Thomas cites Thomas in arguing to overturn decision authored by Thomas. And for the first time ever on this show, I am going to tell you Fox News got that 100% correct.
Wow.
This should be terrifying and not hilarious. So, so let's have our joke, you know, our laugh at the joke. And then I will tell you why this is scary, but yeah. So this was a case called, Baldwin versus United States, decided by the Ninth Circuit. There was a petition for cert to the U.S. Supreme Court that was denied. Cert petitions are routinely denied without comment, so we don't know how many votes there were for cert. We know that it only requires four. That's the longstanding rule. So if Justice Roberts didn't want a part of this, if the Howler Monkey contingent did, they absolutely could have granted cert in this case. I will tell you in a minute why the smarter members of the Howler Monkey contingent did not want to grant cert in this case. But Clarence Thomas definitely did and wrote an 11-page dissent as to why the court should have granted certiorari in this case. And the reason is because the sole issue in Baldwin v. U.S. that was presented to the Supreme Court on appeal was that the Supreme Court should reverse its prior decision in a case called Brand X, in a case full title National Cable and Telecommunications Association versus Brand X Internet Services 545 U.S. 967 from 2005. Right. So Baldwin says, Supreme Court, I want you to grant cert in this case to overturn Brand X. And the Supreme Court says, no, we're not taking this case. And Thomas writes a dissent to say, Brand X is one of the worst decisions that the Supreme Court has ever issued. By the way, quote, although I authored Brand X, then internal quote, it is never too late to surrender former views to better considered position, end of quote. That internal quote was from a case called South Dakota versus Wayfair from 2018 and to a concurrence written by Clarence Thomas. So, yes, cool. In fact,
just tell us what you think. I don't need you to cite yourself about yourself.
Well, but look, that is Clarence Thomas starting to give the game away of, yeah. Look, I used to have a veneer of pretending like stare decisis matters, and I don't anymore. Doesn't matter what I wrote, doesn't matter when I wrote it, doesn't matter literally if I was the lead author on the opinion. Everything's up for grabs if we can make society more terrible.
It sounds like they want he wants a result, a certain result, and then he's going to literally just tear through his own opinions to get there. Is that
correct?
What's happening?
And okay. If you ask, what is this Brand X opinion that Clarence Thomas is so keen to get rid of? A lot of people have been distracted by the fact that it was relevant to net neutrality and relied upon by AgitPi, and it has absolutely nothing to do with the subject matter of the underlying Brand X opinion. What it has to do with is Brand X is an opinion that extends part of Chevron deference. So let's go back. This remains an important hobby horse on this show. I want to give 30 seconds of what Chevron deference is and why it is super important that this is the goal of the Supreme Court right now. Chevron deference will be torn down within the next term. And here's why it is going to make your life as a listener to the show materially worse. Okay.
Just please tell me that the Brand X case involves Batman from 1989.
Totally wish it did.
Jack Nicholson is like, looks like he took Brand X. Remember that?
that's such a great reference.
I love that movie.
But I do too. But that's the last time you're going to be happy in this segment. So,
okay. I'm glad I made the reference.
Me too. So here's why the Supreme Court wants to gut Chevron deference. Because conservatives control the judiciary and they have broken the legislature. So Chevron deference says, when a statute, that is a law passed by Congress, is ambiguous, so long as the agency's interpretation of that law is reasonable, courts must defer to that interpretation. Okay. Now, if a statute is unambiguous, if Congress is super clear about what they want an executive agency to do and the executive agency does something else, then courts come in and go, no, we don't care about your interpretation. You have to follow what Congress said. But where Congress isn't clear, then the courts are not supposed to insert their own judgment over the agency's judgment. Here's why that matters. And this comes up with Thomas, you and I actually had this conversation after the last Democratic debate in which the question of abolishing the filibuster came up. And I was rather surprised to see Warren and Buttigieg on one side and everybody else on the other, especially Bernie Sanders, who very clearly needs to abolish the filibuster to get anything done. And a lot of folks who then sort of wrote in on our Facebook page in when I asked that question, you know, hey, look, if you're a Sanders supporter, talk to me about why you think this is, because it seems odd that the person who has the proposals that are least likely to gain bipartisan support would want a mechanism in place that would require them to have bipartisan support.
Can I take 7 seconds to be mad? Normally I love Vox, but I'm really mad that Vox wrote an article saying Bernie's going to get rid of the filibuster. And then you read it and it's actually not that. Yeah. And so everybody keeps citing that article to you and to me, by the way, as an example of like, oh, no, you dummy, Bernie's going to get rid of the filibuster. And it's like, but I actually read the article and it doesn't say that. It says he's going to use budget reconciliation to kind of get around it, which is not the same thing.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No. Rant over. Really, really important rant. And we could talk about the ability or lack thereof to use budget reconciliation. I'm glad you pointed out. I just want to point out that in that sort of debate, one of the things that was advanced was a sort of, well, look, no president, filibuster or not, is really going to get much done legislatively. And look, like, they're at least going to be able to use executive actions, executive orders, staff executive agencies, and change policies administratively. And I understand why people think that, right? Because when we went from George W. Bush to Obama, and then Obama to Trump, that's what happened, right? Obama directed the military to admit trans service members. Trump says no. Obama says we increase the salary minimum necessary for exempt employees to not be paid overtime, and Trump reverses that. Obama says net neutrality, and Trump reverses it, right? And so there's this sense, right, that, okay, Trump did all of this stuff administratively through executive orders, so Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or whomever is just going to come in 2020, January 2021, and undo all of it, right? Like, that's where we are now. Getting rid of Chevron deference. And again, I can't say this slowly, loudly, or repeated enough. The reason the right wants to get rid of Chevron deference is because they've stacked the court with right-wing activists, and they want the court to be able to come in and substitute their judgment over the administrative agency's judgment. So they want their court to be able to come in and be like, oh, no, now I'm sorry. Like in the old rules under Chevron deference. Yeah. Like Donald Trump was able to do X, Y, and Z. But you can't undo that, President Warren, because you've exceeded the authority the legislature meant to give you as interpreted by us, a right wing judiciary. That's the point. And the reason to substitute their own judgment is they can leave intact, right? Like they get ultimate review, right? So
yeah, is it fair to say that they kind of lucked into this? Like, because haven't they been trying to get rid of this for a while just because of Obama, essentially? And then maybe they've even lucked into the timing of, well, we got Trump in there to do our bidding for a while, and then we can slam the door behind him.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Right. And look, it started as a project of the extreme right, which is now the mainstream right, because remember, their governing ideology is that government doesn't work. Right. And so the more you can hamstring government, right, by allowing judges to insert their own interpretation of statutes de novo, that is with zero deference to the administrative agency's review of statutes, the more lawsuits you can bring, the more you can clog up the courts, the more you can get injunctions stopping agencies from doing stuff, and the more that plays into their argument that government's broken. Right. So the idea is you have a major political party whose ideology is that government is broken. And in service of that ideology, they are out there trying to break government. Getting rid of Chevron deference is one of the ways of trying to break government. So all of that is in the background. This case, we're not even to this specific Baldwin case yet. Now we need to go from Chevron, which again, 1984 conservative opinion upholding a conservative decision by Ronald Reagan's EPA. But it's not good enough for the tear it all down folks. So they've been agitating to get rid of Chevron deference for about a decade. We now have a Supreme Court that is poised to do that. Brand X interprets Chevron deference. It's a subset. It says if there is a prior judicial construction of a statute, that interpretation only trumps the agency's own construction of the statute if that prior court opinion holds that its construction flows from the unambiguous terms of the statute that leaves no room for any discretion. Let me unpack that out of legalese just a little bit, right? It says, so in 2000, or in fact, let's use the case that's actually in Baldwin. In 1992, if there's a court opinion that says this statute means X, and then let's say 20 years later, 2011, there is an internal agency regulation that says, no, it actually means Y, then Chevron deference says we should defer to the agency's interpretation and not the court's interpretation, even though the court's interpretation came first. And Brand X says, yep, that's right, unless the court opinion says, oh, and by the way, this statute means X and couldn't possibly mean anything other than X. Does that make sense?
Makes sense in what way?
did you follow that?
I get
that?
The breakdown, yeah, right. But it's not, yeah. Yeah, okay.
So Brand X is a way of kind of closing the, it's the contrapositive, right? It's the way of closing the loophole on Chevron deference that says, even if there's a prior court opinion, unless that court opinion says this statute is unambiguous, right? Because remember, Chevron deference only applies when the statute is ambiguous.
Right.
Unless it says that, then yeah, the court's prior opinion doesn't constrain the agencies from doing something else. And that brings us to Mr. Baldwin. And in short, what happened here is there was a prior Supreme Court opinion about how you can file your request for a tax refund. Okay. That prior Supreme Court opinion had to do with a 13th century Saxony law provision called the mailbox rule. And it said, even if you are declared by the agency to have not been timely, if you can convince a court that you stuck it in the mailbox at the right time, then you get to go and make that argument at least, right?
All right.
The IRS later added a provision that said, look, when we're interpreting what counts as being timely, we are going to look to the actual stamp on your mail, right? That the actual date that is on the stamp if you send it via regular mail, or the date that is printed when you send it via certified or registered mail, right? Because imagine you can say, well, I put it in the mailbox, but it didn't get a stamp for another couple. It didn't get that, you know, cancellation stamp with the date on it for the next day because the truck didn't come that day, or, you know, it's stuck to the roof of the mailbox, right? Like, there are lots of reasons why under the old mailbox rule, you could go in and argue, yeah, I get it. It doesn't say July 1. The deadline was July 1. But I promise I put it in the box on July 1. So under the old mailbox rule, you were free to argue that. Under the new IRS regs, they're like, come on, it was 2012 at the time. They're like, look, it's the 21st
Wake
century.
Up. It's
like
2012, everyone.
Right, yeah.
Well, but also, how does this apply to laws? Like, they put the law in the mailbox?
Well, they put their request.
The lime and the coconut?
The lime and the coconut, yes. This was a question of what counts as a timely request for a refund. And Baldwin, Howard L. Baldwin, no relation to the Baldwins, argues that he stuck his request for a tax refund in the mailbox at the right time. Now, he then says, okay, in fairness, I addressed it to the wrong department of the IRS at the wrong address.
Came back or something.
Yeah, and so it never got there and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And I get that the IRS regs say that I had to send it by certified mail to the proper place. But if you look by this old opinion, right, from 1992, called Anderson, I would be able to make this argument, and I want to make this argument. So I'm asking the courts to overrule Brand X, to say, no, prior judicial opinions constrain an executive agency from creating new regulations to the contrary. That's a crazy, crazy argument.
Hell of a refund for this guy to do all this litigation and like have a complex argument that I can barely even understand.
Yep.
Wow. Okay. Yep. He must have really wanted that refund.
He must have. And so his argument is overturn Brand X. And the Ninth Circuit was like, well, we're the Ninth Circuit, not the Supreme Court. We're not going to overturn Brand X. And the Supreme Court said, you know what? We're not going to overturn Brand X either. And you might ask yourself, why not? Right. Like if they're so bent on overturning Brand X, why would overturning Chevron deference, why not take this case, overturn Brand X? And the answer is this case is so bad on its facts that Noel Francisco, the U.S. Solicitor General for the Trump administration, who very desperately wants the Supreme Court to overturn Chevron deference, wrote a brief in opposition and was like, look, this would be a super bad case for you guys to take because the plaintiff doesn't even want you to overturn Chevron deference in this case. So this is a bad one. Wait till a good one comes along and then do that. And if you think I'm just sort of attributing conspiracy theories here, this is page 18 to 19 of the actual brief in opposition filed by the Trump administration. Petitioners contend that this court should grant review to overrule Brand X. No sound reason exists to revisit Brand X in this case. As this court recognized in Brand X itself, the rule the court adopted there, quote, follows from Chevron. Petitioners have not asked this court to overrule Chevron, and this case is not a suitable vehicle for considering that step. As long as Chevron remains the law, it would make little sense for a court of appeals to decline to give effect to an agency regulation that is otherwise entitled to deference simply because a prior panel of the same court had interpreted an ambiguous statute differently before the regulation was promulgated. So that's a pretty clear, like, don't say the quiet part loud, guys. And Clarence Thomas did not get that message and instead shouted the quiet part from the rooftops, which is, you know, what Clarence Thomas is wont to do.
At least he was talking.
Yeah, right. So that is the case. That is why the other less stupid members of the Supreme Court, even though they desperately want to overrule Chevron, nodded along and were like, oh yeah, okay, well, we're just going to have to wait for the right vehicle to overrule Chevron. It's coming. Let us not take this one, because when this one gets up here, we realize that the facts are going to look so bad that it's going to make it tough for us to do the thing that our conservative overlords want us to do, and they put that in print. So,
which I find encouraging that there's still some constraints on these people.
Yeah.
You know, because like they could, like, I think Clarence Thomas is probably sitting there like, hey, guys, there's no consequences for
anything. Yes, that's like, exactly, that is 100% what Clarence Thomas is thinking. And everybody else is like, we're not there yet.
They care about their legacy a little bit.
John Roberts obviously does. And, you know, we'll see. We'll see to what extent any of the others do, but yeah, Clarence Thomas is a hack, and he's made it clear that he is willing to be a hack in print, and that is why it is okay to laugh at Thomas, cites Thomas to overrule Thomas, but the underlying case is certainly no laughing matter.
Well, and we're just a matter of time till there's another one, right?
Yep.
That they find better. All right. I think we maybe used up our wild card segment time. What do you think?
Yeah, I have a really, really wonderful letter from that relates to law school admissions. And I know that that is super important to folks right now. So we've got to push it off, but make sure you listen to Friday's show.
Yeah, we'll get to it. But it was worthwhile to cover the music story in depth, because that was super fun and interesting. And also Clarence Thomas being the worst. So lots of good stuff.
Yeah, hey, not that Thomas.
That's what makes it a wild card segment. You know, you can't know one way or the other. We can't always miss it or always hit it. It's a wild card. It's unpredictable. Okay, we've got to thank our top patrons, our Hall of Famers, on patreon.com/law here on Top Patron Tuesday. And I think I'm starting us out. So thank you to Mitch McConnell's Yodel Mountaintop Removal Service. We still got to decide on how this, like, the practical concerns. If you take off the top, then do you fall off, or do you just get to a plateau and you just, because the whole game is you got to fall off the peak. I'm trying to think. Does that, anyway, Samuel Bland, wait for it. The next patron name is super funny. And then Brian Lehman. Well, that's not a good one to go after that. This patron name is a lot more pressure than I was expecting. Obligatory Seattle Live Show plug. Support your locals.
Can we say we are hard in negotiations for Seattle Live Show? So I think that's fair to say. Yeah. So
yeah. The Seattle Live Show. Save that date, everybody. As we told you last episode. Support your local search and rescue volunteers and baseball law podcasts. There you go. Equal. Those are two equal things. By reading this, I hereby invite Silk to join the Lionel Hutz based, and it's gone after that, cut off. After the Seattle Live Show, it's just more Seattle Live Shows. A bunch of question marks. Ziegenhagen, oi, oi, oi. Ian Buckley, hell with my inner child. I'm getting in touch with my inner curmudgeon. Adam called my Senator Larson. Kristen Daniel, let me be clear. I like being totally see-through. I wonder if Andrew and Thomas will read quotes from Belinda Blink or Blinky. I don't know who that is. Murray Gregerson, Colleen Wilson, Lawfulcopter. India is shooting students protesting against bigotry. Yeah, that's getting worse, by the way. I mean, now that Trump went and visited and basically whitewashed over what's like looking, getting awful genocide-y over there, like overtones of you know, deep discrimination against Muslims in India. That's not a good situation. Can we get cert to appeal all of Thomas's incorrect T3BE answers? Support the co-op economy. All must answer to the Inquisitor. Your briefs are tight. Amber Green, let me be totally clear. Torres Smith 2024. Raleigh Live Show, I'll bring a quarantine bubble for Thomas. Clear eyes, full hearts, totally clear. Zirkle, Freudian faceplant. Barry McConacher. Well, I said it wrong, and I'm glad I did, because we'd have to bleep it out. It's it's Barry McConacher. I'm just gonna go ahead and it's two separate names. Fish, today's special is trout a la Seattle the live show. Enjoy your meal. Odin is a truth-telling dog-faced law dog. Emily Rainbow Spence, the unprecedented, resented, demented, present, defenestrated. Dodge dart, bad car, good advice. Jason Kopas, a patron has no name. I miss Game of Thrones. Yeah, I miss when those books used to ever come out, but I'm a fan of the books. Raleigh Durham live show. We will call it QED2. Yeah. Looking forward to the 2020 Marble Olympics. Thank you, Gels Marble Runs. Hotspur live show in Barcelona will make up with tapas and sangria. What? I don't know what the what is.
If you want to fly us out to Barcelona, we will do a live show in Barcelona.
Sure.
100%. It'd just be you. Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah. 100%. My blue blanket. Give me my blue blanket. Dragonfly.eco, books about nature and the environment, reviews and interviews. It's legal, it's advice, it's opening arguments, live in Las Vegas. Michelle Cloud. Well, I can go see my former Sharks head coach. It's a freaking weirdest situation. Michelle Cloud, Tracklight salespeople who used to be lawyers. Nate Drex, stuff and polls. Spoonfeed your kid from the grave because you know they are an F-up. Darth Mandy Pants, Alexa, remind me to vote on November 3rd. Seattle show must have gourmet food, whiskey, wine, and dogs and cats to snuggle. I'm Brewing, 13th century Saxony gravel truck lawyer. Trump reportedly shouts, I am the law, before issuing pardons. Volunteer for your candidate today and take back your government. Jennifer Cratch, remain indoors. I'm here because Diogenes the Cynic was right. I remember when shame was a thing. Spaghetti, the noodle without a moral arc. Soft weeping of the shame boners. Stephen Balticate Sandoval, shop Gita 44. Jeff Gelbach, I have lost the will to be funny in this nightmare timeline. Yeah. Hey Bloomberg, Bojack Horseman has horse-faced thespians. What? CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. The Registry Matters podcast, Insurance Adjusters for Trump 2021, and John Bilderback, your turn, Andrew.
All right. Thank you to Andrea, the arbitrary and capricious, who, by the way, sent in a fantastic question that we're going to tackle at some point. Seattle, home of Westland Distillery, tons of corgis, and OA live shows, indeed. P. Andrew Tortoise, gerrymandering is abuse of power. Catherine Cannell, I am the very model of a modern attorney general. Warren 2020. Eric Alsman, clown on the live show. I just want dinner in Seattle. Payne Strumpet, Thomas Smith is my favorite attorney. Andrew's a close second. Trump's 2020 campaign will look like Weekend at Bernie's. Napoleon, Kiowa Valley exports for Australian red meat and craft beer. The Wandering Gambler. Let me be totally clear. I like being totally clear. If precedence has you down, make it original with pretext. Milo Meadsong stands in solidarity with the UW nurses and their union. Love you, Thomas, but Jesus, make up your T3BE mind. You're killing me. I love the idea of make up your T3BE mind as its own.
Like that's a curse.
Yeah, exactly. Mike Lit Horace, avoiding just despair with genital puns. Yeah, 12-year-old boy puns are welcome here. So our first and only favorite karaoke legend, Cosmo Blues. Join your labor union. Together we bargain. Alone we beg. Live show in Chicago times three. Someday this podcasting empire will rule the galaxy. Yeah. Adam Costa, James Call, Jay Alden Walt. Average underwear are known as OK Bloomers. No. Chad T. Anonymous. The internal body temperature of a tauntaun is lukewarm. Yochai Benkler's network propaganda explains everything. Read it now. WordOrigins.org, your source for legal terms from 13th century Saxony. Closing concessions. I'm glad Andrew agrees it's a yodel stairmaster. Buttercup's Legal Services, proud sponsor of OA's Music City Live show in Nashville, Tennessee. Really? Nashville, Tennessee is
People
Music City?
People are not going to know what the real live shows are because we have so many fake announcements of live shows.
I want to persuade you, though, that Durham is a fantastic city. So,
okay.
My roto dominance bolsingered Arnold T. Pants. Well, yes, indeed it did. Two votes for the Denver live show. That's Puzzle and a Thunderstorm Law. Derek. The little people's opinion on sports law doesn't concern a patron. Well, you're getting more than you bargained for. This pod brought to you by the righteous fury of E. Warren. Andrew, what case can I turn to? 867-US-5309. That is could not be more appropriate for this episode.
Well timed. Yeah, we didn't coordinate this at all.
Big easy blasphemy. The Yodeler achieved escape velocity and is now in orbit. Volunteer this summer. Learn more at campquest.org. Yeah, you should check that out. Rhonda wants an Alaskan live show before it all melts. Atlantis is my favorite Stargate. Universe is a distant last. I have not seen any of the Stargate shows. I imagine you probably have for Philosophers in Space.
I think I misinterpreted that. I thought they were just talking about like this universe is a distant last, but I guess Stargate Universe is a show. No, I haven't watched any of the Stargates.
Sam Buck, David in Brooklyn, Malika Chandler, Abacus Flinch, Soggy Pants, Amanda, my balls itch. Matthew Vernon, adopt a homeless pet and oppose declogging ear docking. Don't take ramp building advice from a podcast. Heather L. Sakashite, Suella Braverman is my least favorite attorney general. Barr is a distant second. Wow, I'm going to have to look to see what Suella Braverman has done, but those are fighting words, Sakashite. Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium, Ian and Ally, Dan Irizarry, Sam Danow, Eli Bosnick. Pass. Alexandra Chalupa, a.k.a. Natasha Crunchwrap. Mitchell, Stormy promised us D-picks. Yeah, we don't want those. She can break that promise. SCOTUS unanimously voted to kill Bob Richards. I agree with that 100%. And, of course, our all-time great, he who shall never be dethroned, Conrad Michaels.
Ooh, all right. Well, all those fine Hall of Fame patrons bring us this T3BE answer.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
Talk to the hand. I need your clothes. That's one of my mission parameters. Trust me. I know now why you cry.
What happened here?
Yeah, so this was a state law that was passed making it a criminal offense for any state employee to knowingly provide educational services or extend welfare benefits to a foreign national here outside of legal status. Principal of a public elementary school was prosecuted under the law for enrolling and providing education to foreign nationals outside of legal status. All of those actions took place before the new law was adopted. No federal law applied to the principal's actions. What constitutional provision would be most helpful? You sort of looked at it and was like, well, I mean, that seems like ex post facto, right? Like, that's the ex post facto clause of Article 1, Section 10, Answer C. And I'm not going to pussyfoot around. Yes, of course, it's ex post facto, right? Article 1.
Well, I mean, I'm a little punchy after that last question, because that was a really, really tough last question. And then this was like, well, this seems incredibly easy. What am I missing? But sometimes that's why I stick with my plan. I choose the logical, easy answer, and it's getting me 55-ish%. So,
yeah,
you know,
and
working okay. But it's not always right.
That's true. Yeah, ex post facto, by far the best answer here. We could work through. There's an okay argument on due process, right? Because obviously if it's ex post facto, you're not getting due process. That was your second choice answer. But the question was most helpful. So the fact that you could make a due process argument, a court would be like, yeah, well, probably, but it's super duper a violation of Article 1, Section 10. Equal protection, not a good argument, because although there is a classification, there's not an inherently suspect classification going on. And the privileges and immunities clause is just sort of right out. Supreme Court precedent, I'm going to quote from the answer key here, limits the protections of the privileges or immunities clause of the 14th Amendment to a handful of rights especially associated with national citizenship, none of which are applicable in this case. So it's almost
so like if you knew enough to know that it applied to like the people he's trying to help.
Right.
Or something. Yeah. But yeah. Okay.
But this is one of those that is just trying to mess with you by being obvious and straightforward. You didn't let it mess with you. Good work.
No, I didn't. Well, there you have it. All right. Back on the saddle. Let's hop in the time machine and find out who our big winner was this week.
Yeah, and I am going to look for somebody who gets this wrong for the most creative reason, and we'll see if we can put them here.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
Well, Thomas, this week's winner is Stormy Decisis, our old pal, who says, I think it's B, public education is guaranteed by residency, not by documentation. The law was unconstitutional to begin with. I think Stormy was the only person really to overthink this question out there, and I love it. And every once in a while, we pick an incredibly well-meaning and well-reasoned thought process as a winner, even though it's the wrong answer. And this time, it is longstanding friend of the show, Stormy Decisis. Everyone should follow them. That is at Nezumi Pi, NezumiPi, on Twitter. And congratulations on being this week's, quote, winner.
All right, thanks so much for listening. We will see you for Rapid Response Friday. See you then.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is a copyrighted production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved. Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our transcriptionist, Heather Leverage, production assistant, Ashley Smith, and with the generous assistance of our volunteer unofficial researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our merch and our live shows and also heads up the OA Wiki project. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian, and Teresa. Check out the Opening Arguments community on Facebook. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the fabulous OA theme song, which is used with permission.